Hello, everyone. It's Friday, October 24th, 2014, and you're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters. And here we are again. Yet another Friday has come, and we're diving into the Constitution of the United States. And on today's program, we're going to be leading things off and continuing our discussion on legislating from the bench, coming up with some ideas on how to get the court system back in the into the condition that the Constitution originally laid out. And then in our second half of the program, we're going to be talking about religion in America, your First Amendment rights of freedom of religion, the challenges to there. There's been a number of cases that have come up in the past week that has really challenged First Amendment religious rights, so we're going to be talking about that. And we are going to be joined today by our contributors, Gary Porter, the Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, Sam Rohr, President of the Pennsylvania and American Pastors Network, Charles Proctor of the law firm of Proctor & Lindsay, and in our second half of the program, David Whitney will join us, Pastor and Senior Instructor at the Institute on the Constitution. And, of course, I'm Bruce Stocking, joined by my co-host, Corinne Lillis. And good morning to all. And how is everyone doing this morning?
I think we're all doing fabulous, Bruce. I want to remind our listeners to check out our podcast of all the previous shows for We the People, Constitution Matters here on 1180 AM WFYL. Head on over to 1180WFYL.com to check out our podcast. And feel free to call in or email in during the show. Our number is 877-667-1180 or 610-539-8255. And our email is info@1180WFYL.com.
There you go. Got to get a little housework in there before we get rolling with the program. But in studio, of course, is Sam Rohr and Chuck Proctor. Gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning, Bruce. Good to be with you.
And on the phone is Gary Porter. Gary, good morning. How are things down in Virginia today?
Hey, Gary, how are you?
Morning, Graham.
Ah, there he is. There he is. Yeah, we got a little glitch there. We had to get a button to get you on the air. How are things down in Virginia this morning, Gary?
Well, I haven't peeked outside yet, but I expect it'll be a wonderful day.
Yes. Yeah, it's always a wonderful day on Fridays because you're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters right here on 1180 AM WFYL. And, Gary, we are going to lead off our discussion this morning, the first half of the program dealing with legislating from the bench. And you have written your piece for this week that deals with some issues about what we can do to possibly fix the problem. And you have addressed that American people, they are ignorant with the Constitution and what it says, and actually designates the work of the courts. And maybe bring us up to speed, Gary, on that and your recommendations for discussion on, well, some things that can be done to correct what's been taking place.
Well, Bruce, the American people need to understand, and I don't think they do very thoroughly, that we have a community of judges on the bench at various levels of our judicial system who do not understand the Founders' Constitution, or if they do, have decided that is not where they'd like to see America remain, that is, in that sort of a framework. And they have the power, they've been given the power by the American people through their acquiescence to move the country away from the founders' view of how government should operate and how there should be the intermingling of religion and government. Mm-hmm. And so if the people don't get down to understand the Constitution, understand what's happening pretty soon, the judges are going to move this country well away from where we were and where we need to be. The founders made it very clear that if there's some complete attempt to separate religion from government, government is going to fail. Government is going to fail. So we just can't allow this to happen. But people don't understand that it is happening, and they don't understand the remedies that are available to put a stop to it.
And you've laid out some of the remedies, Gary. What are some of those remedies that come to your mind?
Well, there are several. There are several that can be done right now because they're perfectly part of the present Constitution, such as impeachment. Judges can be impeached. They have been impeached in the past, and that's a remedy that would certainly put a stop to this if the people would be willing to demand it.
Gary, I have a quick question for you regarding impeachment with the judges. I know it takes a while for a president to be impeached. What's the process like for a judge? Is it similar? Would it take a while?
It is the same process exactly. Impeachment of any federal official follows the exact same process, whether it's the president or a lesser official. There's only one distinction, and that is if it's the president that is being impeached, and that has happened twice, then the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court must sit in the trial in the Senate. That is the only distinction. If it's anyone other than the president, then somebody else, probably the leader of the Senate rather than the vice president sitting as the president of the Senate, would be the presiding officer. Other than that, the process is exactly the same. The House of Representatives composes articles of impeachment, discusses those, votes on those, and then they go to the Senate for the trial if the articles of impeachment pass in the House. And we've removed federal judges and one Supreme Court judge from the bench through that process.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the other recommendations that you might have with along from the impeachment? You've got others on your list.
Well, we need to realize that in terms of federal judges, it is the president who nominates these men and women, and the Senate concurs through a vote to their nomination. But so it has to start with electing better presidents, presidents who understand and respect the founders' Constitution, mm-hmm. hoping therefore that they will elect or nominate judges who share that philosophy or share the founders' philosophy of government. If we continue to elect presidents who have a disdain for our Constitution, as our current one does, then we're going to get federal judges nominated who are going to be difficult to turn down at the Senate unless there's some obvious flaw in their record. We're going to get federal judges and more of them that have this same, let's move the country forward into some progressive nirvana sort of philosophy.
Yeah, exactly. And you've also laid out things such as, term limits. And, of course, I think there's a lot of Americans out there with not just judges, but along also with the elected officials out there, the term limits in the Senate and in Congress are in order itself. You also talk about judicial stripping, and maybe if you could, we're going to have to take a quick little break right here. But when we come back from the little identification break, because we're going on air live, is maybe you can explain what judicial stripping is.
Absolutely. It's nothing obscene.
All right.
That's right, Bruce. I want to extend a welcome to all those now tuning in on your radio dial. 1180 AM WFYL is licensed in King of Prussia, Philadelphia. We thank you for tuning in. We encourage you to email in or call in. That's 610-539-8255 or 877-667-1180.
All right. Thank you very much, Corinne. So, Gary, judicial stripping. What is that?
Right. That's a common term that's been applied to it. It's not that term itself isn't in the Constitution. But in Article 3, Section 2, Congress has the authority to define what the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court should be or will not include. And so they have the authority, and they've exercised this on a couple occasions, to tell the Supreme Court, you cannot judge on or render an opinion on that particular topic. Now, they used this authority one time, even during a case, while it was being heard on at the Supreme Court, that Congress issued a law which denied the court the jurisdiction over this particular topic. And the court, when they got this delivered to them, they shut down the case. They said, we no longer have authority to rule on this case, so we must terminate it in midstream. And so it's a very powerful power and perfectly constitutional. Now, the problem is, if the court has already rendered some sort of opinion on that topic or on that issue, then what this does, if you invoke this at that time, then you remove from the court's jurisdiction the opportunity to reverse that judgment, or for them to reverse that judgment, because they can no longer hear a case on that topic.
Mm-hmm.
So this can only be used before the court has rendered an opinion on a particular subject matter.
Okay, so it does show the fact, because a lot of folks think that, well, the Supreme Court is the ultimate final authority, but Congress can overrule and basically shut them down. And considering someone who's appeared in front of the Supreme Court and some thoughts on there, I want to bring in Chuck Proctor.
Bruce, good morning. One of the things that I think Gary will is familiar with, and I know Sam is the problem of in the last 50, 60 years when First Amendment cases came up in particular, and the ACLU or another organization would bring a lawsuit, nobody would show up on the other side. Literally, there'd be one attorney in the courtroom, and the judges have no choice but to rule in favor of that particular argument that the ACLU or whatever organization that they were making.
That sounds like a game where the other team comes up and it forfeits.
Exactly. It's like only one team shows up. And as a result, that was one of the impetuses for organizations like the Alliance Defending Freedom and other organizations getting together and saying we need to show up in the courtroom and start fighting these battles. I believe, in my opinion, that the mindset of federal judges became, well, this is what we should be doing. We should be taking the side of the ACLU. We should be advancing these progressive causes, and we can do it here from the bench, because they were empowered by a lack of appearance. Since ADF, for example, has come on the scene in the early 90s and has started defending these cases, their success rate is over 80%.
Mm-hmm.
In any court, whether it's a district court or Supreme Court, over 80% in defending these cases. And in many times, all it takes is a letter from an ADF attorney to a school board or a municipal authority, and they stop the activity immediately. And you don't hear about that.
No.
So there's been a lot done. The cases, the high-profile cases, you hear more about. But that lack of anyone showing up, or anyone showing up in any kind of concerted, cohesive effort, I think did a lot of damage in the last 50, 60 years.
Yeah, I'm saying.
Gary, and I think you'd agree with that.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And I'd put out a shout for ACLJ as well in their efforts in this arena.
Yeah. And, you know, what gets me is why in a situation like that the other side would not show up in a case. But, Sam, your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, there's one other thing I would add in addition to that is that, you know, the assumption, I think, has been all along through the history of our country that the good voters, in other words, those who have been voting constitutionally, wanting good law, that kind of thing, have operated under a false assumption, in fact, that everybody that they think is there is all doing their job. And in fact, they're not. And I would throw one additional thing just for consideration here is that, you know, not only do we have, as you've talked about, Gary, judges who employ a progressive thought, who are not really governed by the law, who don't really consider their constitutional oath to be their guiding principle, those kind of things. In addition to those things, I think there's also a point I'd throw in here I believe has contributed to it, and you can tell me your thoughts on it. But from a legislative perspective, from where I have been for so long. I have always felt that in many cases there are good laws that are passed that almost invite legislative action, and there are, I mean, bad laws, and then there are good laws that are written very tightly. I found one of the things that have been happening over the years is that when law is passed on a given item, it's generally passed by the legislature because they're responding to some kind of controversy, some kind of an issue they're dealing with. But they don't really want to resolve it really too tightly by law, so they always put in a disclaimer in there that allows the legislative branch, whatever, to take and write the regulations to enforce it, or a wide open scenario, which then allows the almost encourages the executive branch to write law, and I think set it up almost perhaps even like the Affordable Care Act, almost invites some kind of judiciary action, which then permits these strange rulings to occur. So I'd like to see what you guys think about whether or not there are laws that can be passed that invite progressive activism, but from the metro.
Well, Sam, going to that. For example, in the Conestoga Wood Hobby Lobby case, the final order issued by the district court judge in this matter, there's a footnote that says, in an overabundance of caution, the government reserves the right to enforce in the future, any law that may be passed by Congress or by administrative fiat regarding this subject matter. And where does the bench get the authority to legislate and make a judicial decision in the future? Yeah. That hasn't even come up yet. And so this is part of the problem where some of the things that are done, I think, are to just test the mettle and the fortitude of the American people. The ACA Act and the HHS mandate itself, any attorney with any constitutional background at all would have known that the penalty imposed on Hobby Lobby was way too much. They would have known that the rule of general applicability they had violated. They should have known. It was, I don't want to say it was a slam dunk, because obviously you had four justices that disagreed, but that was written into RFRA, into the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, those principles that had to be applied. So how they could get away with it, particularly when you're looking at a $36 million fine for Conestoga, the Supreme Court has held that a $5 fine is too much.
Mm-hmm.
So why they would even do that, and so it begs the question that Sam's saying, I think some of the legislation, some of the activity from the bench is designed to test the mettle of the American people. And so many Americans are sitting home and they're not paying attention to this, that this stuff just rolls along.
Well, and however, I think also that falls into something that we've talked about with this topic, and of course every topic with this program so far is, but with judges, is a judge is supposed to be, once seated on the bench, above the fray of politics and the rule on the merits of a case, but yet, as we all know, that isn't happening. And to put it in layman's term, to use politics in ruling and to just jerk the American people around and use them as test guinea pigs to see, well, you know, it's the old thing, hey, will this carry the show in Erie if I play it? That's just totally wrong. And, you know, one thing that, Gary, you have in your list there with the impeachment, you talk about judges should not be impeached because of their performance on the bench. And I kind of look at that in a business management realm with an employee. If you have an employee with a performance problem, it then falls on the employer to improve that performance by training and whatever measures. But a person can be removed by conduct. And in my mind, and I'll go to you first, Gary, on this, in my mind, using politics to sway your ruling isn't a performance issue. That's literally a conduct issue.
Well, yes, but you have to realize that the pendulum swings both directions. And so you could have under that scenario, you could have a justice who is, in fact, enforcing the founder's constitution removed because the party in power has an opposite view. So, you know, you have to be very cautious about power, and that could work against you. But let's talk about term limits for a moment. We normally think of the term limits as applying to senators and representatives. Every time it's come up, it has been used in that context. Let's put some term limits on our representatives and senators so that they can return to the people, as the founders would say, and get a fresh view of what life in the trenches is like. But I think we need to start talking about term limits in terms of judges.
Oh, absolutely.
The founders thought that judges should serve for good behavior, the federal judges, that is, for life, because they envisioned judges being selected who were beyond reproach, who were virtuous men and women, who you know, could be trusted. And we've seen exactly the opposite of late, and we've seen judges who don't have the judicial philosophy of the founders. They don't have the philosophy of law that the founders shared. And so you have to have a mechanism, I feel, for removing judges who have proven that they do not share the founder's vision. And that can only come through a constitutional amendment. So people need to start talking about that, I think. We need to have a broad discussion about whether that's really in our best interest. I think it is, but the people whose document it is need to decide that.
Okay, we've just got a few more minutes left, and let's go quick roundhouse, Chuck.
Gary, one of the things I've seen in practicing law is quite often a judge will be elected at the state level to, here in Pennsylvania, the Court of Common Pleas, and they're not on the bench 6 months a year, and they're appointed to a federal position. And from there, they're appointed to another federal position. They don't have the experience of 5 or 10 or 15 years on the bench to bring to the federal court. And I've seen it time and time again, both from a political and political correctness standpoint almost. And some of the judges, yes, are well qualified. They spend the next 10, 20 years there, 30 years there. That's fine. But when there are no requirements for your experience, and we saw that with Justice Kagan has never sat on the bench before she went to the Supreme Court. I think that's a critical component to serving, and our founding fathers, I think, thought that that was implied, but now when you look at the Constitution, it's not there, and barring, as you said, a constitutional amendment, those requirements, that experience, that level of sophistication in the people we put on in those very, very important positions, even at the district court level, which you think, well, okay, that's the lower level, but that's where it starts. We need to do something about that. And from that standpoint, I would support a constitutional amendment regarding not only the term limits of the federal judges, but the requirements to be one.
Yeah, Sam, you
absolutely.
We've got about a minute. Sam, you want to jump in on that one before we take a break?
Well, my comments would just be brief on this. A term limit perspective, I think, is something that does bring some kind of finality to this concept that you can do whatever you do for as long as you want to do it. But very clearly, for those who are listening, I don't think that it certainly shouldn't be a 2-year or a 4-year term. It needs to be a longer term because not a life thing. There needs to be a term. I think that would be a beneficial thing, but there is advantage to obviously having age and having experience, which is what Chuck was talking about, state experience, federal experience. So there is a reason to extend the length of time beyond what we're used to, and we think 4-year legislative or a 2-year election term. Mm-hmm. But there should be some finality in it, in its term, length of term overall, just because of all the reasons we're talking about. It sure would not hurt.
Yeah, I think it's a good point that Chuck brought up with Kagan, never sat on a bench and now sitting on the highest bench. You got to go through the lower training before you can go up and drive the big car, let's say. But that was a good analogy there. But we're going to take a break.
Yeah, we're going to head to a commercial break, quick commercial break. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters, here on 1180 AM WFYL. Stay tuned.
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
Welcome back to It's a New Day. I'm sorry, I have my days mixed up. This is We the People. It's Friday. It is Friday. I hope everyone's having a great Friday so far. You're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters. My name is Corinne Lillis.
And I'm Bruce Stocking.
And we are joined by Chuck Proctor, Sam Rohr, and Gary Porter, possibly getting joined by David Whitney later on. But we were talking about legislating from the bench. We're going to quickly wrap that up and then move towards religion in America. But I want to remind our listeners, you can call in 877-667-1180 or 610-539-8255. So if we want to wrap up legislating from the bench quickly.
Yes. When before we went to the break, we were talking about, impeachment and term limits and various other little remedies out there to get the judicial system back in. And, of course, Chuck, you pointed out before we went to the break about Justice Kagan, who never sat on any type of bench whatsoever. I don't think that woman ever judged a cupcake baking contest. And here she is sitting now on the highest court in the land. I guess that's what you call hope and change.
Absolutely. And on top of that, I don't know what her courtroom experience is. If she had been had an extensive history of it as a trial attorney, that would be a huge help.
Yeah.
But when your whole life has been political and working for political and executive branch of the government, yes, you may be an attorney, but that is not going to equip you to sit on the United States Supreme Court, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And no disrespect, she may be a very bright lady and what have you, but it was more, that was a political appointment. And because she was a woman, because of her background, the Senate is like, boy, if we vote against her, that's going to look bad at election time.
Well, here we go again with the politics.
Exactly.
Being involved, not let alone ruling from the bench, but picking those that are going to sit on the bench itself. And in my mind, gentlemen, that by doing such thing, you have rendered a court such as that kind of null and void. It's the Ted Mack amateur hour.
Yes, and when I was in front of her back in March, she asked very good questions from her perspective. They were good questions and supporting her viewpoint. But keep in mind, she has not only a staff of permanent employees, she has her clerks that are doing the hard work for her, the heavy lifting, so to speak, and she gets up there on the bench and looks good.
Well, not to
say that she hasn't thought about it. Obviously, she did. But as we saw just this week, Justice Ginsburg had to retract a portion of her dissent in the Texas voter ID law because they'd made some serious mistakes, not only in style, but in a couple of factual matters that they misrepresented in their dissent.
Yeah, and a situation like that reminds me of the old sailing ships of old where you had a figurehead on the front. Didn't do anything but look pretty good sitting there.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So, Sam, your thoughts on that one? With judges such as Kagan going in there, never sat on the bench, part of the problem?
Well, obviously it is. And again, it brings it back, as we've talked off from the beginning, that, again, Pennsylvania, we're going to bring it back to William Penn. You must put into office those of integrity and character in all levels of civil government. That does not mean just the justice. That means those who are in the legislative branch. That does mean those in executive. Any person must be run through a very similar grid. They must be experienced, but they must have those very clearly identified elements of integrity, truthfulness, honesty, commitment to what they, all those kind of things. Because at the end of the day, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about people who are basically dishonest.
Yeah.
Why is it so hard to get honest people? I don't understand why. I mean, I guess it falls back on the people electing those into office that aren't honest, but I just don't understand why. I don't know. I just think it's we're making it way more complicated.
Gary's in the background there. Jump in, Gary.
Well, Corinne, do you remember that definition of education we read a long time ago from Webster's 1828 dictionary?
Yep.
What did it say? Education and morals is of prime importance. Now, where does that take place these days? It does not. So it, unless the parents take a concentrated effort to instill morals in their children at home, and even then they're fighting upstream given what is happening in the public school, but unless that takes place, you're not going to have people of virtue and integrity who reach adulthood and are then capable of taking those virtues and into public office.
Well, and also to bring it for the public out there, of course, you know, this is one of the things when we get into the Constitution, we get into identifying these problems and offering solutions and where to go with this thing. A lot of folks, you know, and I said this last week, can feel overwhelmed. And, of course, to get people to understand things, you know, they have to be able to relate to them. And perhaps with what we're talking about here and what Sam continuously brings up, and I want him to continue to bring up on every program, the fact about the moral and good character of people, this is very important because it's not just the Supreme Court. It's not just the halls of Congress. It's not just the executive of the United States, the president. This also fits into all walks of life. If you're an employer, hiring people, if you're going to hire somebody, be it an attorney, a doctor, who you know, whatever, you want those qualities because that gives confidence, that gives trust, and that is what is so lacking in all realms nowadays.
And I think this, Bruce, has kind of ties into the religion in America thing, because I think a big reason why all this these dishonest people are getting this power is because God is being pushed out of the picture.
Exactly. So. In fact, you know, that's the next topic I want to go to. But, Gary, bring us home on this one on legislating from the bench. What can the American people out there who have listened to us, we've identified, we've given some solutions there, kind of bring us home on this one on
It has to start at the local level. It has to start at the individual level first. We have to become informed as a people, as individuals. Then we need to start engaging with our local and state representatives. There needs to be a groundswell of support for this. We can't start just by knocking on the doors of Congress and say, let's have a constitutional amendment. It has to start with a groundswell of support at the local and state level that Congress has no option but to listen to and to act upon. So I would encourage people to, if you don't know the phone number of your state representative, if you don't have that memorized, then memorize it and start using it and start talking with those people at the local and state level and make sure that they are sharing your view about what needs to happen in this country.
Yeah, and so, if I could throw in one thing that Gwen Alexander from Action of PA said with representatives, if they get 10 phone calls in their office on a subject itself, those 10 phone calls can change that representative's opinion and direction.
That's right. I've got my representative's phone number on my telephone.
Speed dial, right?
Speed dial. So, and everybody needs to do that. Everybody needs to establish a relationship with your local representatives to find out who they are, what they're about, what they believe, and start talking to them about these issues.
Yeah, Sam?
I would agree with that as well, and I would throw into my perspective here as well, that these elements, these foundational elements that lead towards the defining of what is integrity, the defining of what is character, the defining what is are these things that we're talking about. You talked about it coming from the home. It must, and I'll go one step further and said, this is the kind of thing that was there in preparation from the pulpits of America at one point in time. And that is where it must come again, because this is moral truth. These views that we hold to and say, what constitutes honesty? What constitutes integrity? What constitutes the concept of duty and responsibility that we're talking about that is assumed within the context of our constitutional republic? It stands in stark contrary comparison to those who would be an atheist, as an example. They would not perceive any of these things that we're talking about to be important. Matter of fact, they're on the other side. Islam is on the other side of the equation. They would not view these things, honesty, integrity, duty, totally different than what we're talking about. So we've got to understand that what we're talking about is a Judeo-Christian view. Mm-hmm. It is a view that is clearly distinctive, that is not found in any of these other ideologies, and we cannot be afraid to distinguish and understand that that's why it must be coming from the pulpits of America, because it will not be coming from anywhere else.
So how do we get... Go ahead, Sam.
Not just the pulpits, but the people of the Christian churches need to be having discussions, seminars, roundtables, whatever you want to call them. They need to be aware of what is happening around the country to suppress the Christian religion in all sorts of venues. And once they become aware of what is happening, then they and their pastors together need to start a groundswell of support for these remedies.
Exactly. And gentlemen, you're laying the nice segue into what I want to get to. But before I get to that, I want to get some thoughts from Chuck on this one.
Well, Bruce, it's very interesting. Whenever we interview in my office a new associate attorney, one of the questions that we ask them is, there's a statement out there, a common statement, that all lawyers are liars. And I ask them simply, what's your viewpoint on that statement? Now, you would think that automatically, right off the top of their head, without thinking, they'd be able to give me a crisp, clear answer that says, boy, that we need to, if that's the perception of the public, we need to change that, and that's not true, and I would never operate that way. You know what I get? I get a long pause because they're thinking about, what does this prospective employer want to hear?
Yeah.
And I'm sorry. And of course, after my many years of trial work, I can tell when somebody's sincerely thinking about it or when they're trying to dodge their way around it. And I don't get straight answers, very few straight answers on that subject. And I've had attorneys come out of the courtroom.
Now, Chuck, isn't that most politicians are attorneys? Yeah. So, you know, that's why we don't get a straight answer.
Exactly. Yeah. But I have come out of the courtroom and I've had my colleagues at the bar after the hearing or the trial or what have you, and I'd say, where did that come from? And tell me, absolutely say, quote, my job is to lie for my client.
Well,
and that's the culture, that's the atmosphere we're in.
You know, and that's very interesting because to bring that up, I saw an interview that Bill O'Reilly did with the attorney of the Michael Brown family. And which he was sitting there. Now, this guy is an attorney. And he was, well, we should take this officer and go write the trial on this thing without the grand jury. It's a mess in that. And Riley's telling me, well, it's our judicial system. You have to do this. You can't go to trial unless you have a very good cause to do this. And he said, well, we don't need to do that. You know, there you go.
Exactly. And if you'll notice, and I saw that interview myself, by the end of the interview, the attorney was backpedaling because he realized he'd stuck his foot in his mouth and he was trying to maintain his position for Michael Brown.
Yeah.
And now we're starting to hear some of the facts, not all of them, but some of the facts about what really happened in the police car, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not passing judgment on that at all. And that's the purpose of the grand jury, is to get those facts. Now, it is an anomaly that it is the one part of our judicial process that is not open to the public.
Right.
But I understand the concept of, if the jurors are intimidated by two opposing sides and the public and the press, they're not necessarily going to be as objective as they might be.
Well, and you also...
I can understand that,
yeah.
But it is an anomaly in our system.
Right. You also have with the grand jury. I sat on a federal grand jury. We just kept getting extended. It ended up 2 years. Yeah, that was brutal. But the fact is that you have the prosecutor presenting evidence to a grand jury. They have this grand jury go, yeah, I think you got enough there. Or to come out and say, no, and of course the old thing is a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. But the fact is the evidence produced there, the jury says, yeah, I think you got something. And I think you've got something. It isn't making a ruling on the case, but it's to show that there's evidence there to go forward to a case to hear this thing out to see if it's true. So,
I have a question
for
Sam. You mentioned earlier, just a little bit ago, about we're talking about Judeo-Christian values and principles and all that. And so some people of other religions might not see this as important. So then how do we get people of other religions to care about this stuff? How do we stress to them that this is important, even though it's what it's our Judeo-Christian values? I mean, how do we get other, people of other religions to see that this is so crucial without us forcing it upon them in a way that seems like we're trying to change, you know, how people are? But how do we get them to see it as important?
Well, I think there are two ways. Ultimately, that's what the gospel is all about.
Yeah.
The gospel is what changes a person's heart. And ultimately, that is what changes one's appearance and view of what is honest and just and right and wrong, and why I'm going to discipline myself and why I want to be accountable and so forth. But that's one part. But our system, you remember Penn here in the Puritans, when they came, they wanted this to be a shining city on a hill. What does a light do? A light is visible a long ways off. This holy experiment here, our nation with our constitutional rule of law and self-government and all the things that we're talking about that are now under such a great attack, it was a convincing fact for all the people. I mean, it has been the hope of the world, of the people who want to come here, because they saw the difference. Mm-hmm. So there are two. So people are persuaded by two things. One, they can see the obvious results. And we have been a demonstration of that. But you know what? As I travel around the world, and I'm finding people on all the parts of the world right now, they're looking and they say, we want to be what America was, but not what America is. Hmm. Because there is a very distinctiveness and difference in the way we are performing now, and when we have judges that do it all the time, we're talking about all of these things we're talking about were never envisioned by our founders. It is contrary to the very underpinnings of who and what we are, and the rest of the world sees it.
Hmm.
At the same time.
But I feel like America doesn't see it. A lot of people in America don't even see it.
In some cases, it's more visible over there than it is
for
our own.
It's also the fact is, you know, you got to look at people and what we've talked about during the week on It's a New Day, too. What do they care about? You know, what are the distractions? And they look at, well, it doesn't affect me, so I don't mind about it. So when's the next football game coming out? But that kind of brings us to our next topic that I want to get into, is the fact of religion in America. And this fits into the courts, because right now, it's not covered much by the major medias. We've covered it here, and we're going to continue to focus on these things. But you have three religious judicial cases that are going. We talked a little bit last week, at the beginning of the show last week, about what's going on in Houston with the mayor using the legal system there to subpoena sermons from the pastors there. We have another situation which, Corinne, you reported earlier this week. Mm-hmm. I think it was in Colorado, about a minister and his wife that is being threatened with arrest and judicial process on them because they don't want to marry same-sex couple.
Yeah, that was in Idaho.
Idaho it is.
Yeah.
And Chuck, you mentioned this morning before we went on the air about in California with an abortion issue. So now we have the judicial system being manipulated as, the only way I could put it, a terrorist weapon against ministers. Am I right on that?
Well, I think it's broader than that. I don't think it's focused against ministers as much as it's focused on, it is a war on Christianity, period, end of statement. There is a war on Christianity going on in this country. You only need to start looking at these individual cases to draw that picture.
Yeah, and in fact, there's two analogies on this. One, David Whitney had mentioned about, you know, where he stated it's not really a war on religion as it is on God, and God is the foundation of this building called the United States as a nation. You weaken that foundation, the structure will fall. And then there's one that, Corinne, you've taken the heart about a tree.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Dr. Peter Lilbach said this last week, and basically explaining if you think of a person as a tree or a group of people as a tree, their roots, if they're grounded and they have their foundation, you know, then it can't easily be moved by weather or whatever. But if you take away the roots of the tree, then it can easily be picked up and moved anywhere. So we have to be so careful with our historical roots, our religious roots, all that, Because if we don't have strong, deep roots, then we're going to easily be moved with the times.
Yeah.
And I would say, Gary, just throwing it from Sam's perspective here, you're talking about a broader war, not just a judicial. That would be correct, because in a couple of these three cases, it was judicial, but the Houston issue was not judicial. It was an executive branch. It was the mayor's office.
Yeah.
And
right.
so you're having a cultural war against the very underpinnings of what constitutes biblical Christianity, and it is coming from both the executive branch, it's coming from the judicial branch, it has happened in the legislative branch where they've passed laws that are counter to it, but it is abroad. So that I say that to underscore what you're saying, it is a frontal assault on the very underpinnings and foundation of all of the things that we're talking about, and we can't think of it in terms of an isolated skirmish here or there.
Yeah, let me bring...
Hey, Bruce?
Yeah, go ahead, Gary.
Bruce, let me mention something concerning the Houston situation. There's an event being scheduled for the 2nd of November. It's called I Stand Sunday, and it is a group of speakers who will congregate in Houston to talk about the particular situation they are facing down there. There will be a live webcast at 7 p.m. That Sunday night, and a rebroadcast of the event at 9 o'clock Eastern Sunday night. So I would encourage people and your listening audience who want to have more information about what happened down there and what the present situation is to tune in to that I Stand Sunday event.
Yeah, where can they tune into on that one?
Well, they have a website called www.istandsunday.com, and that has all the information they'll need.
Excellent, excellent, because this is something that just cannot be neglected as the media wants to do on this. This is a fundamental, important aspect of that, and that's good information. Chuck, you mentioned the thing about with the abortion in California, if you can enlighten on that one a little.
Bruce, as I understand it, and I haven't had a chance to dig into it in depth, but as I understand it, there's about a 40-year-old law that was passed that, if you read it properly, says that they can't force churches or other religious objectors to perform abortions. However, they're now trying to construe that same act, and in spite of recent rulings and other things that have happened, to say that churches must provide health insurance that provides elective abortions for women, and that this is part of basic health care. It is so contrary...
We're back to the Hobby Lobby thing again.
Exactly. It's so contrary to what's happened in the last year that it's almost inconceivable. And the reading, and I need to read it more carefully, and Gary, maybe you've had a chance to look at it, but my understanding is that if you read it properly, it prohibits that activity, and yet they've construed it, that whoever in California is trying to enforce this has construed it to say, no, you must pay for it in your health insurance premium. And that's just totally offensive to anyone, whether you believe in abortion or not, because the next thing is they're going to tell you what else you can believe in, what else you can do, what else you can support from the government's standpoint.
Yeah.
Not yours, not your personal beliefs. They're not going to matter.
Yeah, well, you know, and I find us all interesting. You know what you're talking about, Gary, what you've mentioned, and Sam, is that, you know, this pesky Constitution, this pesky First Amendment of the Constitution, no law respecting and or establishing religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridge the freedom of speech of the press and so forth and so on. And it's like, it doesn't exist. It does not exist because it doesn't fit into our political realm, so we throw it away and we proceed forward because, as some would say, who's going to know? You know, is that your thought on this, Gary?
Well, the one thing I would kind of summarize this with is that, for me, the pace of suppressing Christianity in America is accelerating. This abortion issue out in California, the Houston issue, all that says to me is that the pace that the people who would like to suppress Christianity in America have been emboldened by the current atmosphere, and they are going full bore to accelerate this effort of theirs.
Yeah, Sam, I want to give you the last word on this one before we You have to end for the day.
Well, Bruce, I think I guess my last comments on this would be that, again, we are talking about the Constitution on this program. We're talking about what we've referred to as the rule of law. And we're understanding that civil law, good civil law, always, well, any civil law, has some moral law component that undergirds it. In our Constitution, it is biblical moral law. That is the context, and that is the concept of law. Those who wish to live outside the law, activate from the bench, legislate from the executive branch, they want to actually become the law. This is the epitome of humanism and a postmodern worldview. This is what's standing in contrast to all that must be understood relative to the Constitution and our representative republic if we are to keep it. That brings us back to biblical moral values, which we can discuss more as we go forward.
Yes, and I think that's what we'll be picking up next Friday. Believe it or not, gentlemen, next Friday will be Halloween. This is getting pretty scary in itself, so we'll follow up.
Well, but remember, it is also Reformation Day.
That's right. That's right.
There you go.
Halloween is actually All Hallows' Eve before All Saints' Day. But that's going to bring us to an end on this Friday, October 24th. I'm Bruce Steiking, along with Corinne Lillis. I want to thank Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, Sam Rohr, President of the Pennsylvania and American Pastors Network, and Chuck Proctor of the law firm of Proctor and Lindsay. We did not able to make contact with David Whitney. Hopefully we can do so for next week's program. But it's going to be a beautiful weekend out there, folks. I say get out there, do something with the kids, do something with the family that's meaningful, and we'll catch you right back here next Friday for We the People, Constitution Matters. Have a good weekend.